Wandering the watershed of the Colorado River can be one of the greatest adventures of a lifetime. For me, it has been a lifetime adventure that began in the 1950s and continues to this day. My name is Jack Loeffler, and I'm inviting you to join me on this final episode of Moving Waters, the Colorado River, and the West. The landscape here is regarded by many as the most beautiful on our planet. Much of it is the red rock country of the Colorado Plateau, and much of it is pure desert. One of the first things people do when they move into an area is to name the landforms. In this way, we learn the land and provide ourselves with a sense of place. In the parlance of different Indian tribes, we hear of Toroweep, Agathlan, Tsilthna Odetle, Babat Dawag. The Spaniards named La Cabeza Frieta, Cerro Negro, Mesa Verde, El Rio Colorado, El Rio San Juan, El Rio Escalante. Anglos had their day with the Bear's Ears, Fish Tank Canyon, Molly's Nipple, Muley Point, Comb Ridge, Lavender Canyon, Wolf Hole, and countless other names. I've thought about the mosaic of human perspectives that this landscape has yielded and continues to yield by explorers, exploiters, and artists alike. Jim Bridger and other mountain men financed their personal adventures as they gathered pelts and hides from animals that once prevailed in abundance in the watershed. Brigham Young and other Mormons found ways to irrigate parts of this arid landscape and founded communities that continue to endure. John Wesley Powell explored and mapped the rivers and landforms in the 19th century. Writer Everett Ruse vanished from this landscape as he journeyed through the Colorado Plateau. Many American writers, artists, and musicians have taken great inspiration from this land of infinite hues, whose endless song is expressed by canyon wrens and coyotes. My late compañero and camping partner, author and philosopher Edward Abbey, and I trekked for thousands of miles through the Colorado River watershed. No one knew this region better than Abbey. His great lament was the construction of the Glen Canyon Dam that resulted in Lake Powell. Ed wrote 21 books, including the great environmental classic, Desert Solitaire, and the well-known novel, The Monkey Wrench Gang. Many years ago, I recorded one of our conversations wherein Ed Abbey revealed the heart of his philosophy.
By virtue of being alive, we deserve to be respected as individuals. And I'm saying that that respect for the value of each human being should be extended to each living thing on the planet. Our fellow creatures, beginning with our pet dogs and cats and horses, humans find it easy to love them, and we should learn to love the wild animals, the mountain lions and the rattlesnakes and the coyotes, and developing that way to extend our ability to love to plant life. I think a tree, a shrub, deserves respect and sympathy as a living thing. And I can even go beyond that, to the rocks, to the air, and to the water, because it's all part of the whole.
Ed Abbey understood philosophically that the planet, even the universe, is an integrated system. Craig Thompson, who teaches at Western Wyoming Community College in Rock Springs, brings his scientific perspective to the same notion.
An aquatic ecosystem is the sum total of all of the plants and animals in the watershed and in the water itself that depend upon the river. And we especially are concerned about the interactions between these plants and the animals, between the water as it dissolves rocks and the dissolved products of those are taken up by the plant system and they begin that food chain. So it's not just looking at the biotic community, the living community, and the non-living community. What we're especially interested in an aquatic ecosystem is the interactions there, monitoring the system of the exchange of energy and of nutrients and minerals that result in this incredible thing. I mean, I've been fascinated with aquatic ecosystems, you know, my entire life.
The Colorado River watershed is indeed a complete system. It can be perceived in many different ways. The river lures one on many levels. Ronnie Egan is an adventurer and whitewater river runner. She told me about running lava falls in the Grand Canyon in her own raft.
The first time I rowed my own boat through, I had two ladies in my boat who had never done river trips before. So they were like river virgins, and I was not exactly a lava virgin, but I was in terms of rowing my own boat. And somebody had told me that it's a tradition that the first time you run lava, you have to run it naked. I've never heard that before or since, but anyway, just after we had scouted, we all got back in the boat, and I jokingly said to my two ladies, "Well, are we going to run naked?" And they said, "Sure," and started disrobing. And I thought, okay. And so we disrobed down to just our PFDs and our sandals and our jewelry. We were all wearing special jewelry. And ran it in the buff. And John Hoseman was last, so he was behind me. He said he got quite a view when we all stood up to scout it as we entered the rapid. I had a big old bruise on my butt. So anyway, we ran it. We hit the V-wave and dropped down into the maelstrom there. We were upright and pointed correctly, so we all stood up and mooned the crowd as we went by.
Bruce Babbitt was Secretary of the Interior under President Clinton. He has a heartfelt opinion about both the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act and their effect on development within the Colorado River watershed.
Well, NEPA is a remarkable document because it's not a substantive law, it's a process document. But the courts really put teeth in it in terms of insisting on real process. It's made an enormous difference. It's kind of an affirmation of what real democratic process does. Real democratic process, properly worked, does tend to bring people to their senses. And it's done just that. Now, the Endangered Species Act, in contrast, is a substantive law. It sets out a set of criteria which says, thou shalt not do or take actions which will have the result of endangerment or threat of extinction. And the Endangered Species Act, during the last 10 years particularly, has been a very effective stick on all Western rivers. And it's worked. In each case where there's been an endangered species problem, we look back closely into the river system and see that there's a lot of water sloshing around being inefficiently used, and we can redesign uses and revive and restore rivers and protect species in the process.
Neither the National Environmental Policy Act nor the Endangered Species Act had come into effect when Ed Abbey wrote The Monkey Wrench Gang. It was this novel that inspired a new generation of environmentalists to take activism seriously. This novel also focused in part on the Glen Canyon Dam and has instigated a growing movement to decommission this dam so that the Colorado River might again run wild, at least as far as Lake Mead. Attorney Pam Hyde is the Director for Policy for Southwest Rivers and is in the vanguard of those who would see the dam decommissioned.
It's the compact that really caused the Upper Basin to push for the construction of Glen Canyon Dam. If we hadn't had the compact with a split at least ferry with a delivery requirement right there, there wouldn't have necessarily been a need to create storage just upstream from there. But the Upper Basin states went, wow, as long as we've got this delivery requirement, we need to have some way to assure that even in dry years, we've got the means to meet that delivery requirement. Let's build a storage facility just upstream of the dividing point. Now we've got a huge reservoir in the middle of the desert that evaporates a huge amount of water off the top, which doesn't make sense when you have a limited amount of water. Why should we be losing hundreds of thousands of acre feet to evaporation? If we could go back and eliminate that split, eliminate the delivery requirement, have some other way of allocating and sharing the water, you might completely eliminate the need to have these huge storage facilities.
Luna Leopold is regarded as one of the great hydrologists of all time. It was he who first published the American classic Sand County Almanac that was written by his father, Aldo Leopold. Luna has some interesting comments about reservoir evaporation.
The evaporation losses from Lake Mead are about 5% of the average inflow to the lake, or about 700,000 to 900,000 acre feet per year. The soluble salts from the evaporated water are left in the lake. So you're losing 700,000 to 900,000 acre feet per year from Lake Mead alone. There's not much difference between Lake Mead and Lake Powell.
When he was still a child, Chuy Martinez was a migrant laborer whose travels took him throughout the great irrigation districts of the West and beyond. He went on to become a union activist working with Cesar Chavez and also performed as a musician.
El estado de Arizona, un lucero apareció. Fue niño, joven y hombre, César Chávez se llamó.
And I can remember seeing the river when it was full and then when it was almost dry. And what a sight. You get really saddened when the river runs low. I remember we used to just stop and jump in the river and take a swim. And then a few years, it didn't seem like it was that long when they had signs that the water was polluted, that there was danger on that part of the river, or, you know, that something spilled. Or it was a lot of that in a matter of just a few years. Not only because of that, but also when they used to use the pesticides to spray the crops and all that. You know, around that time was also one of the big issues in the union, was especially that, because they used to spray a lot. And a lot of that will contaminate the water. Because I remember as a child even drinking water out of the river and the ditch. They usually feeds off the river.
Don Pope is the manager of the Yuma County Water Users Association, who have senior rights to about a third of Arizona's entitlement to the Colorado River. Here, he describes the importance of this water to the people of Yuma.
The state of Arizona has 2.8 million acre-feet of entitlement on the Colorado. And of that 2.8 million acre-feet, we happen to have approximately right at one-third of that amount here in the Yuma area. It's the senior one-third. So we consider it pretty much a drought-proof allocation. And that amount of water here makes us a $1 billion-plus ag industry here in Yuma. Yuma is the winter lettuce capital of the country. Between Thanksgiving and Easter, a full 75% and often at times as much as 90% of the iceberg lettuce consumed in this country comes from Yuma.
The farmers of the Imperial Irrigation District on the other side of the river are working diligently to find means of conserving water. This district receives the lion's share of California's apportionment of 4.4 million acre-feet annually. Rudy Maldonado is the president of the Board of Directors of Division 6 of the Imperial Irrigation District. He tells us of irrigation conservation methods that are used in his district.
Well, there's different irrigation methods. We can use drip irrigation, and we do that quite a bit now. There's dead level irrigation, where they level the field, and so there's absolutely no runoff, but that takes money to do that. Then you have pump back systems, where you have pumps at the end of the fields that'll collect the water in a reservoir and pump it back to the beginning of the field. And then there's combinations of other ways to irrigate. You know, our farmers are pretty creative. And that's one of the things I think that we wanted to get the input from the farmers, because they're the ones that would have to implement these processes to make up the conserved water. You know, again, our farmers will really determine what methods will be used to conserve that water.
The coastal cities of California are coming to rely more and more on the Colorado River for their water. Both the Metropolitan Water District of Los Angeles and the San Diego County Water Authority are purchasing water from the irrigation districts of the lower Colorado River. Historian Norris Hundley is the author of The Great Thirst. When I met with Norris in Santa Barbara, he revealed a great deal about these water transfers.
The Metropolitan Water District of California has an agreement with the Imperial Valley for about 100,000 acre feet. MWD also has agreements with Central Valley agencies, some of them in the Central Valley Project, some of them not part of the Central Valley Project, for transfer of agricultural water to cities. Now, there are some restrictions. The law makes some restrictions on this sort of thing, but a determined seller and a determined buyer have been able to work these sorts of things out to date. The San Diego County Water Authority has an agreement with the Imperial Valley to take 200,000 to 300,000 acre feet of water from the valley. And what's the incentive? Why are farmers wanting to do this? Very simple. It's money. For example, the Imperial Irrigation District pays the Reclamation Bureau roughly $40 an acre foot for water, for which it has a contract with San Diego to to get $249 an acre foot. Transfers of water from agriculture to cities has some potential serious byproducts. If the farmers succumb to this in a major way, you're going to see the disappearance of open spaces, you're going to see the disappearance of agriculture, you're going to see the intensification of urban sprawl. And some UC scientists recently released a report which indicated that within a decade and a half, 2 decades, that the Central Valley is going to consist of a series of large cities surrounded by virtually non-existent agricultural enclaves, covered overhead by smog, all the way from Bakersfield to north of Sacramento.
In a very real sense, agriculturalists are competing with developing cities for the precious waters of the Colorado River. The great irrigation projects are withering in the face of the shift from agrarian to urban economics. Ethnobotanist and author Gary Nabhan is a great critic of these modern trends.
One interesting thing that you bring up is this competition between urban areas and agricultural areas for water. And I think it's one of the greatest fallacies that has been put forth in the public arena, that for years we learned that Arizona was first using 90% of its water for agriculture and then 85%, and by some analyses it's now down to 80%, and that it was incredibly wasteful and we should make agriculture get more efficient and allow more of that water to be used, quote, democratically by the people in urban areas. So Phoenix and Yuma and other towns in the Colorado River bottomlands have expanded grossly into the most fertile, irrigable lands in Arizona. When you look at the water use per unit area for 100 acres of condominium development and say that that use of water is going to continue to grow or at least be maintained near that level because the condominiums aren't going to go away. That land will never come back to agriculture. Water use per unit acre is much, much higher for urban use than agricultural use and offers none of the environmental amenities in terms of open space or cleaning the air or wildlife habitat that healthy agriculture could offer. Originally, the Central Arizona Project was planned to help Arizona farmers, and now most of its transfer of waters is clearly being used to fuel urban growth rather than promote a healthier agricultural system.
Patricia Mulroy is the general manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority and one of the wisest of the so-called water buffaloes of the lower Colorado River. She finds great hope in this recently developed practice of water banking, wherein water is pumped cross-country from the Colorado River and deposited in lake beds, where the water is supposed to seep back into overmined aquifers in Arizona.
What I really like about the banking arrangements is it forms partnerships. It creates mutual futures, not individual futures. The Colorado River is a mutual future, and it starts binding and bringing together benefits and consequences. We don't mind paying the money. I mean, it's going to cost us $170, $180 million, but we know we're not paying any profit or any markup. We're paying what it costs. I mean, the state of Arizona shouldn't have to pay for us. We're paying our fair share, and we're paying what it costs to bank the water, and we're paying what it costs to retrieve the water, as if that banking operation was in Nevada. Arizona is not hurt. Arizona benefits. They have the benefit of the environmental restoration because the water's going into the ground. They have the benefit of it helping their water management picture in the state of Arizona. And we have a future supply of water in the state of Arizona. And if times get tough, we have a drought bank to where we can mitigate the consequences of a drought here in this urban area.
For years, California has been pumping far more than its share of Colorado River water. In his final days as Secretary of the Interior, Watermaster Bruce Babbitt demanded that California get back in line with its annual apportionment of 4.4 million acre-feet, as defined in the 1922 Colorado River Compact. Ed Marston is publisher of the High Country News, one of the most informative publications to come out of the Intermountain West.
Well, over Babbitt's 8 years in office, he, with the help of other people and under pressure from the other Colorado River states, encouraged, forced, cajoled California to agree over the next 15 years or so to skinny their use down to 4.4 million acre feet. In return for that, California got a guarantee that it would have enough water, no matter what the weather did, to get it through the next 15 years, that it wouldn't be cut off as it could be legally. And that extra water will come out of the 56 million acre feet that's being stored in Lakes Mead and Powell. In other words, if there's a drought, the other states and the federal government have agreed that they will draw those reservoirs down far enough to keep California in water.
Again, Bruce Babbitt.
The California problem goes back a long ways. The other basin states not using their draw, California expanding, metastasizing like crazy, sucking up the water, really kind of threatening to blow up the compact arrangements. And what we said to California was, we've got to resolve this in the framework of the compact. You've got to reduce your draw. And the way to get more water these days is not more dams, not more reclamation projects. It's efficiency and water transfers from agriculture to urban. And you, California, have a lake, an ocean of water sitting out there in the Imperial Valley. It's the oldest rights on the Colorado River. It's several million acre feet a year. There's plenty of water if we'll just get down to the business of working out the economics of transfers. It took some pressure. We had to go back and really lean hard on them. But it's done, and I think it's a model for how we find water in the future. We can find it through efficiencies and transfers.
There is a growing movement of environmentally conscious people on either side of the international boundary who are seeking water to restore the delta of the Colorado River. For many years, almost no water has reached the Sea of Cortez. The result is that the ecosystem of the delta has been deeply wounded. Many species are now endangered. Many fishing communities are also endangered. Dale Pontius is an attorney and Colorado River scholar. Dale addressed the international movement to restore the delta.
People who have been working on ecological issues on the border, and in particularly in northern Mexico, have felt for years that there wasn't anything in the 1944 treaty that dealt with ecological issues, obviously. In those days, people didn't think about it. And they wanted to have something in the way of amendment to that treaty that would start a process whereby the two countries would begin to develop ideas and hopefully a program that could be implemented to restore and protect the fragile ecology in the delta south of the border. And there's been growing pressure from a coalition of nonprofits, conservation groups in Mexico, and certainly with a lot of input and leadership from the U.S. side. And they formed quite a coalition, and they've started to have an impact in terms of the Mexican government becoming aware of these issues. And particularly the new administration in Mexico seems to be very sensitive to this, and they've made overtures directly to this government from that administration saying, it's time we dealt with this issue. And Secretary Babbitt, in his last speech to the Colorado River users, said the big unfinished business item on the Colorado River is the restoration of the delta.
Elena Chavarria and her husband Carlos Valdez Casillas have been in the vanguard of the environmental movement in Sonora, Mexico for many years. Elena speaks of non-governmental or NGO participation to urge the government to move forward.
The law has changed, the environment law. NGOs are working closer to the government, but I still don't see serious commitment. I would like to see more of that. And certainly, I'm not that kind of a Mexican who will say this is all blame of the government. It's only a reflection of us as a citizen.
Steve Cornelius is a biologist who works with the Sonoran Institute. His research focuses on ecological requirements of restoration of the delta.
We need to have some better understanding, frankly, of what we're talking about when we say we need to restore the delta. Until that geographic scope of restoration has been defined and agreed to amongst all of those who are expected to contribute to its restoration, it's going to be very difficult to agree on how much water is really needed and what its quality is, what its periodicity is of the flows. And especially, it's going to be very difficult to identify the sources for that water.
Again, Bruce Babbitt.
You know, anyone who's ever read Aldo Leopold's essay about camping and canoeing in that delta prior to Hoover Dam, we'll never have the same view of what we did to the Colorado River. And I think for years people said, well, it's beyond hope of ever restoring. What we've done in the last 4 or 5 years is started to rethink that. I've had a lot of conversations with Julia Carabias, the former Mexican environment minister. She began raising the issue, doing all this restoration all over the United States. Well, what about this salt flat that used to be this lush, wonderful delta? We began talking about it. We set in motion some study groups, and they're coming back saying that a relatively small amount of water could revitalize and restore a significant part of that delta. And what we now need to do is keep those discussions going, recognize that we have an existing block of water in the Welton Mohawk drain, which is already going into the delta and which must be preserved as a delta block, and that we can, in fact, free up some additional water. People say, where? What I say in response is, from a lot of different sources where the water is currently being wasted and not wisely used.
The Colorado River is indeed the aquatic lifeline of much of the American West and northwestern Mexico. It serves a burgeoning human population of 25 million of us who rely on these waters for our very subsistence. It also serves all of our other fellow species on whom we rely and who rely on us to maintain balance in our home environment. As I've wandered the watershed of the Colorado River, talking with friends and acquaintances whose points of view reflect the extraordinary cognitive diversity that abounds here, I've come to understand that only through a deep sense of mutual cooperation will we as a species come to grips with the social and ecological dilemmas facing us today. I'm going to conclude our series by reading From Down the River by Edward Abbey, and I quote, "We glide down the golden waters of Labyrinth Canyon. The water here is smooth as oil, the current slow. The sandstone walls rise 1,500 feet above us, radiant with sunlight, stained with old tapestries of organic residues left on the rock faces by occasional waterfalls. On shore, wheeling away from us, the stands of willow glow in autumn copper. Beyond the copper are the green-gold cottonwoods. Two ravens fly along the rim, talking to us. There will always be one more river, not to cross but to follow. The journey goes on forever, and we are fellow voyagers on our little living ship of stone and soil and water and vapor, this delicate planet circling around the sun, which humankind call Earth." Moving Waters, the Colorado River in the West, is a production of the Arizona Humanities Council. Executive Director Dan Schilling. Our series is sponsored by the Humanities Councils and Endowments of Arizona, California, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. Funding was provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Ford Foundation. The project director is Nancy Dallette. The executive producer is Marcos Martinez. Our production assistant is Celestia Peregrina Leffler. Our theme was performed by Carl Bernstein. The series was produced in its entirety by Jack Leffler in Santa Fe, New Mexico. For Moving Waters, the Colorado River in the West, thank you for listening.